Mr. Tuckwood.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tatiana Sanchez, and I'm a student here in the Faculty of Science at McGill University. Christopher Tuckwood is the executive director and co-founder of the Sentinel Project, a Canadian NGO dedicated to assisting communities threatened by mass atrocities worldwide. They do this through the innovative use of technology and direct cooperation with the people in harm's way, monitoring countries like Kenya, Burma, Iran, and Sri Lanka. Chris has a bachelor's degree in medieval history from the University of Waterloo, which he thinks is a great example of how someone's major is no limit on what they end up doing in life. UW was also where Chris got his start in anti-atrocity work focused on the genocide in Sudan's Darfur region, which set him on the path to creating the Sentinel Project. He also has a master's degree in disaster and emergency management from York University, with a wide range of interests, including early warning, intelligence analysis, technology, and communal resistance to atrocities. Chris speaks and writes regularly about human rights, technology, and atrocity prevention, and currently teaches a training course on using technology to defend human rights, as well as leading the Una Hakika project to counter atrocity-linked misinformation in Kenya's Tana Delta using mobile technology. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Christopher Tuckwood.
Okay, how about now? Perfect. Thanks. So today I'm here to talk to you about the promise and potential of using technology for defending human rights. This is an area with tons of exciting things happening and even more potential in the future. So understanding this topic is really an essential part of being a human rights defender in the modern era. So over the next hour or so, what I'm going to do is, what I'm going to do is try to give you some background on why technology is so relevant in this field, some of the principles we can apply to do this effectively, and see where things seem to be heading in the future. Along the way, what I'm going to do is also use some of my own personal experiences to illustrate some of these points. I'll tell you about things like how I got started in this field, as well as my own work with the Sentinel Project. I also have several other examples that I'll try to share. I should note that my main experience relates to dealing with mass atrocities and things like genocide, but all of these sort of lessons definitely apply to human rights more generally. So a lot of the principles transfer over between the two, and I'm going to try and use a mix of examples. So no matter what your personal interest or cause is, and I imagine that all of you have your own sort of areas of expertise or things that you want to do in your life, there should be something here that takes away or sort of that you can take away and apply to that. Now, I do have a tendency to talk a bit much, so what I'm going to try and do is restrict my comments, since we have limited time here, and leave time at the end for you guys to answer questions or make comments or what have you, because I've heard that all of you are pretty insightful and have been challenging some of the other speakers over the week. So I'll give you a chance to do that with me as well, and hopefully after you're done learning about who I am and what I do, I can actually get to learn a bit about all of you and who you are and what you do. Whether it's during the formal question and answer session after my talk or afterwards just in the hallway, if we have time, feel free to come up and talk to me really about anything that you want. So over the next hour of learning, you're going to get to know a bit about me and a bit about my work, and you're going to notice that there are some themes that keep coming up, three in particular. So number one is big. It's this idea that we live in a time of opportunity when it comes to using technology really for anything, but especially for defending human rights. Two is that we have to understand that technology is constantly evolving, which probably won't come as a surprise to anyone here, so we need to be constantly learning and creative, because as technology changes, we need to change, and our thinking about it needs to change. And the third theme that you're going to notice is that using technology in this field is just about as much about people as it is about hardware or software. Tools enhance how people work and how they behave, but they don't replace the actual human beings who are standing up for their rights. Now, it's important for what we're trying to accomplish here today that you understand who I am and where I'm coming from. Of course, you already heard my sort of official introduction at the beginning there, but what I want to do is tell you a bit more about my personal story and how I went from being someone who started off very much like all of you to being up here on stage today and doing the work that I do on a daily basis. So for me, my interest in human rights, and specifically mass atrocities, started when I was about 16 years old, when I learned about the Rwandan genocide. Now, when the Rwandan genocide actually happened, I was around 10 at the time, and really wasn't particularly aware of it. But fortunately, when I was a bit older, when I was 16, I happened to catch a documentary on TV one day about Roméo Dallaire, the Canadian general who led the peacekeeping mission in Rwanda. And for some reason, that story, that documentary, really resonated with me. And it did that in a way that nothing else ever has. And I knew deep down, for some reason at that time, that I had to devote my life to making sure that crimes like this never happened again. Sorry, the slides are a bit non-responsive. There we go. Now, of course, when I learned about Rwanda, like I said, I was 16 years old. And I really didn't have a clue about what to do about a thing like genocide. So I spent the next few years educating myself and really thinking a lot about the subject, but not doing anything concrete. And I'm glad I did that too, building up that knowledge and building up that sort of body of thinking personally about the issue of genocide. Because by the time I got to university, I finally, though I don't think I would necessarily use the word fortunately, considering the circumstances, I finally had the opportunity to do something about this issue. And that's because in 2003, which is the year I started at the University of Waterloo, the Sudanese government launched a brutal campaign in the western part of that country. Their ultimate goal was to defeat rebel groups in that area, in the Darfur region, which is actually three states in western Sudan. But they did this in what is sort of their traditional way of dealing with rebellions in Sudan, as they had for decades already. And that's by targeting the civilian populations who they saw as supporting the rebels. And this is kind of, it's been called draining the pond to kill the fish. They would get rid of the civilian populations who supported the rebels, and then the rebels wouldn't be able to operate. And they did this by sending government airplanes to bomb villages, and then following that, militias that they had trained, called the Janjaweed, which means devils on horseback, would come in and burn, kill, rape, plunder, and generally drive out the population. So at the beginning of what came to be classified as genocide in Darfur, there were 6 million people. That was the population there, 6 million. A few years later, half of those people were homeless. They'd been driven out of their homes. Hundreds of thousands were dead, whether having been killed outright or starved or dying of disease or thirst in the desert. Most of those people still have not gone home today. So, how did I respond to this as a 19-year-old first-year university student? Well, I knew something had to be done. And since I was a brand new student at the time, I saw an opportunity on the campus around me where not many people actually knew about this issue. Nobody could probably find Sudan on a map, let alone Darfur, let alone tell you what was actually happening there, except for a very small number of people that I was fortunate to run into. And so over the next 4 years, my friends and I built up one of the largest and most active student organizations in the area working on this issue. And our mission was to educate people about genocide, and we focused a lot on Darfur specifically. In order to do this, we organized special events like conferences, gained local media attention, held fundraisers to send humanitarian aid to Darfur, appealed to political representatives, and organized an annual walk in which we got people to travel 1 foot for every person who had been killed in the first year of the genocide, which meant we had to walk 23 kilometers. And the goal there was to give people a sense of the scale of the tragedy. And we were very successful with what we did on campus over those first few years. But as we were doing it, we also started to see that although what we were doing certainly mattered, it absolutely did, there still remained a very long and indirect sort of linkage between getting someone to sign a petition or make a donation or write a letter to their member of parliament in Canada and actually saving somebody's life on the other side of the world. And that realization is what got me thinking about different ways to address the issue of genocide and similar crimes. One of the things that had become very clear to me as I educated myself over the years was that genocide is not some spontaneous, unpredictable event. In fact, it's the result of deliberate planning and preparation by the perpetrators. And if you can spot the warning signs of that process early on, then you have more options to do something to disrupt it and prevent it from getting to its ultimate end. So the idea for the Sentinel Project started to come together. Now, as I got ready to leave university, I handed the reins of our campus organization to someone else and started thinking about the future, both for myself and for this type of work, asking myself, what should our next steps be? Fortunately, it was right around this time that I happened to meet some other people who shared this vision of, you know, directly assisting communities at risk, and also brought in the technological element of what we were trying to do. And it was clear that a new approach was needed in order to help the people in harm's way when addressing genocide, and eventually we would broaden that to other mass atrocities, and certainly you can apply this to human rights issues in general. We knew that early warning was the key to that approach, to helping the people in harm's way, and in turn, the key to early warning was technology, and taking advantage of the best tools available to us in this time of opportunity that we live in. And that's where the idea for the Sentinel Project started coming together, and so we jumped in and decided to start our own NGO right out of university. Now, starting an NGO is not an easy task at any point. Especially if you're fresh out of school, though, it's particularly difficult, especially when you have no personal experience doing such a thing. Of course, running a large student organization definitely was great preparation, but campus activism came with a lot of advantages that aren't easy to find once you graduate. At Waterloo, we had access to funding support, a large number of committed and enthusiastic people, and other organizations with similar interests. Everything we needed was in one place. However, getting out into the so-called real world was very, very different, and it was a totally different story. And we spent a lot of time figuring out what exactly it was that we wanted the Sentinel Project to do and how we would make that happen. And this was a process that took many years before we started actually getting to the point that we could consider ourselves established and successful. But fortunately, all the way along, we had two guiding ideas that really sort of helped to keep us on track in terms of what we were doing. First was cooperating with people at risk. And the next slide should be coming up. There we go. So the first one of these two guiding ideas was cooperating with people at risk. And second was taking advantage of the tools available to us and the time of opportunity in which we live. So cooperation with people at risk. What exactly do I mean by that? Well, in short, it means that we don't want to just be outsiders who come and impose what we think are the right solutions on a very serious problem that people are facing. Particularly a very much life-threatening situation in another part of the world where they far better understand their situation and the dangers that they face than we ever could. Something I noticed when I was involved in the Save Darfur movement was that for all of its success, there were almost no Darfuri people at the forefront of that. It was very much a Western-based movement. And that makes sense for a lot of reasons. There are good reasons, logistical and otherwise, for why that happened. But we wanted the Sentinel Project to incorporate communities that were actually in harm's way into what we were trying to do. History has shown that the response, the majority of the response to any disaster, whether it's a natural disaster like a flood or a hurricane, or a man-made disaster like conflict or genocide or other human rights abuses, the vast majority of the response to that actually comes from the people who themselves are impacted or who are the neighbors of the people who are impacted. So we wanted to try and find a way to help those people directly affected, the potential victims of genocide, who know their situation best and help them to improve their response to that. They're naturally the best partners for doing this kind of thing. Now, that second founding idea I mentioned is the time of opportunity that I keep mentioning. So what exactly do I mean by that? Well, it's a recognition that when it comes to technology, today's world is a very, very different place than it was even in the recent past. And this difference is generally a very good thing for human rights defenders, because we now have access to absolutely unprecedented capabilities. We know that if we, or we knew at the time, that if we wanted the Sentinel Project to be successful, we had to get creative and make use of all the best tools at our disposal. Now let's consider this time of opportunity and what those tools are that we have at our disposal and why they're so significant. And I'm going to come back to the Rwanda example, just because that's where I got my start, and it also illustrates a very significant contrast between the world of 20 years ago and the world of today. So it just so happens that 2014, this year, is the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. Let's have a look at what the technological landscape was like back then in 1994. This is significant because information, which is hugely dependent on technology, especially on a global scale, was a major excuse by powerful governments for not intervening and saving lives. They said that they did not know the nature or the extent of the mass murder happening before them, as though the slaughter of as many as a million people in a small country in the presence of an international peacekeeping force and media coverage somehow went unnoticed. That's patently untrue, particularly in the case of countries like Canada, the United States, and France, all of whom had some stake in the events that were happening in Rwanda. It may, however, have been true for the average citizen at the time. In 1994, the most advanced piece of technology that most people could access was a television or a fax machine. The internet was still very much in its infancy, and both home computers and mobile phones were really more expensive toys or tools than part of everyday life. And that's talking about the context for people in wealthy, developed countries like Canada or the United States or in Western Europe. For most of the world's population at the time, radio was still the most common way to receive information, and that was a decidedly one-way flow of information, with control concentrated in the hands of just a few people. When it came to learning about world events in 1994, most people anywhere in the world relied on mass media and were at the mercy of producers and editors who decided what they should watch, listen to, or read. Now let's look 20 years later, at today. There's a big contrast here. We now live in a world with 4.5 unique mobile phone users. There are actually more subscriptions than that because people in a lot of parts of the world will have more than one phone number. But there are 4.5 billion people in the world, almost the entire adult population of the world, who own and actively use mobile phones. And 2.7 billion people with internet access. That's a huge change from 20 years ago. Now we have the ability to reach out and communicate with virtually anyone else in the world. And once you get talking to them, that communication is almost instantaneous. And that applies to even some of the poorest, most remote, and most violent parts of the planet. This newfound ubiquity of mobile technology is changing economies, governance, development, and numerous types of service delivery and social interactions worldwide. And it's not just about those numbers either, although they're impressive themselves. It's where those numbers are coming from. Much of the growth has been in less developed countries, especially in Africa and Asia, where people are adopting mobile phones at a much faster rate than anywhere else in the world right now. It's also about what they're using the phones for. Most of those 2.7 billion internet users, they're accessing it through their phones, because for most of them, having a computer is just too expensive or doesn't fit their lifestyle. And when they're on the internet, a lot of people around the world are highly engaged through social media, which probably comes as no surprise. And what that means is basically that people no longer are just passive consumers of information as with conventional media, things like print, radio, and television. In fact, now they can actually generate their own content and engage in conversations, breaking down social barriers, mobilizing movements, becoming citizen journalists. Technology is enabling huge numbers of people all over the planet to become more engaged with the broader world around them. So as I mentioned earlier, there are some principles that I would like to cover today. This is a good time to have a look at the first one, now that we've gotten kind of an idea of the technological landscape in the world and why it's so significant, and the fact that things have changed so rapidly. So the first of these principles that I want you to walk away knowing is obviously related to using technology for defending human rights. In our online course that we teach about this topic, we have 12 of these. What I've done for today is pick out basically the top five that I want you to come away with today, because there's no way we would cover all 12. And the number one principle that you need to know is to always link technological tools to real-world activism, or real-world action, rather. And this really sums up those two founding ideas that I told you that we have at the Sentinel Project: cooperating with communities in harm's way and taking advantage of the best tools available. In short, you have to ensure that your campaign is using technology to actually change something. Now, it doesn't have to solve every problem in the world, obviously, but it should try to solve at least one of them and be doing that in a logical way. You need to understand the problem, understand the potential solutions, and then see what tools are most likely to be successful in helping to make that happen. Technology really is all about gathering information and moving information around, but we don't just gather and move information for the sake of doing that thing in and of itself. Online activism has to support people taking real actions in the real world, even if it's indirect. For example, think of a map. That's a very basic and old piece of technology. But it is, in fact, technology. It's a tool that people use in order to do certain things in the real world. And a map is a basic technology for capturing and presenting information about the world. But we don't create maps just for the sake of creating maps. They're intended to aid people who are trying to accomplish things in that world. Sometimes people get excited by cool technology itself and forget to constantly ask themselves whether the tools are genuinely helping to solve a problem. So don't let that be you. Now, I want to also give you sort of a note of caution here when it comes to technology in our field. New tools don't always mean new techniques. They can certainly mean doing things more effectively, but there seems to be, with some people, this perception that technology in itself is something completely new as a category. And technology really encompasses a lot of things and has for more than the past 20 years. And it's really not the case that technology is something new. It's not just the internet, it's not just mobile phones. Sure, the internet and mobile phones have absolutely new tools, and very, very powerful new tools that the world has just become, or have enabled the world to become, a lot more connected in the past 20 or even the past 10 or 5 years, just as I finished telling you. And I'm certainly not going to deny that by any means. However, the concept of human rights defenders using the best tools at their disposal in order to accomplish their objectives is nothing new. We just have incredible tools available to us right now, but activists have always sought out ways to enhance their activities that would otherwise be carried out by other means. It's about people doing things. If they have tools available to them that let them do those things more effectively, then they absolutely should. We might look at tools like social media to understand a crisis, or document abuses, or mobilize people, maintain freedom of speech, or give a voice to the voiceless. But those aren't activities that just came into being in the past 20 years alongside the internet and mobile phones. People were doing them long before that, using whatever tools they had available at their disposal. So what I want to do is take a look at some examples from the 20th century of people using seemingly old tools now that most people probably wouldn't even call technology today. The printing press is one of the oldest forms of technology that's been used for political or human rights or social purposes. And it actually remains, of course, a popular means of disseminating information and coordinating resistance when other forms of communication are inaccessible. During the Second World War, most of Europe was under German occupation, and free speech was almost always very seriously restricted by the invaders. And one of the countries with a very extensive underground resistance network to the German occupation was France. Of course, in the pre-digital age, disseminating information to a population was not as easy as it is today. There was no Twitter, there was no Facebook. there was no, ability to coordinate instantly their activities using things like email or other means. But the French Resistance used the resources available to them and started publishing underground newspapers with as many as 500,000 subscribers. And this enabled them to evade state censorship of controversial topics and publish their own counter-propaganda. A similar example comes from the Indian independence movement from the British Empire. And the next slide should be coming up. There we are. So the Indian independence movement the movement for independence from the British Empire gives us another example from right around the same time as the French resistance to German occupation. India was then, as it is now, a very large and populous country with vast disparities in wealth and education amongst its people. So for leaders trying to gain independence for the country, this posed a significant challenge in building a movement, especially after a major government crackdown landed most of the Quit India movement's leaders in prison in 1942. In response, the remaining free leaders of the movement set up what they called Congress Radio, and this was the official broadcaster of the Indian National Congress, which went online in August 1942. Congress Radio's main goal was to provide the Indian people with uncensored news in order to that they could stay informed about the independence struggle and the crimes committed by the authorities trying to crack down on it. This was intended to serve the higher level objective of maintaining a so-called leaderless movement, which is very similar to how social media, particularly Facebook and Twitter, have been used in recent years to organize protests against oppressive governments worldwide, especially in the Middle East. Of course, the need to share information in order to accomplish anything didn't go away. It's eternal, and so even if we skip ahead a few decades, we still see this holding true in the modern era, whether because of the emphasis placed on the role of photocopiers and fax machines, things that we generally think of as pretty low-tech, if not obsolete today, whether we think of those in the context of the Soviet Union, or even more recent protests during the Arab Spring. It's all about getting out a message, whether on paper or electronically. So the machine in the top left of the screen, or of the slide, is basically a small sort of tabletop printing press. And it was used in Soviet Europe in order to print banned literature and circulate this amongst the population. Now, of course, the value and impact of just printing literature like that is debatable. Of course, pieces of paper don't ultimately overthrow governments and bring democracy and human rights. But if it's any indication of the potential impact of that literature, communist governments in various parts of Eastern Europe actually closely controlled access to things like typewriters, requiring them to be registered with the government or secret police in some places, and generally banning them from private ownership. Typewriters may seem obsolete to us today, but they were once the newest and best technology put to use by human rights defenders for circulating information. And the people who they were fighting against, the repressive governments that they were fighting against, definitely recognized that. And if anything, their response to that threat of the typewriter and the threat of the photocopier is a strong indication of the value of sharing information when it comes to defending human rights. And my final historical example here is one of my favorites, since it really illustrates how technological tools are nothing new to human rights defenders. But many observers today continue to see them that way, and sometimes actually give too much credit to technology. So in 2009, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he's no longer the president, stood for re-election with several reformists opposing him. And a lot of the opposition supporters fully expected victory because Ahmadinejad's popularity had been declining quite a bit. The election took place on June 12th, and once again, the reformists, the opposition supporters were definitely expecting a victory. But state media very quickly, actually before the counting of the votes was actually complete, reported an easy victory for Ahmadinejad, which sparked large-scale demonstrations almost immediately as opposition members and members of the population expressed their regime, or rather their anger at the regime, which they felt was ignoring them and suppressing democracy. Social media and mobile phones, especially Twitter, played a significant part in mobilizing these protests, as well as documenting the resulting crackdown, which was then shown to the outside world. In fact, social media sites like Twitter maintained one of the only information links to the outside world when conventional journalists were banned from reporting inside Iran. And this led to a largely Western obsession with social media as, in and of itself, bringing democracy and protest to Iran, which is why they were dubbed by some the Twitter Revolution. Now, it's been argued that this gives far too much credit to the technology itself rather than the people using it, which may be true. But I find the more interesting point here in looking back to 1979. That was the same year when the Islamic Revolution brought to power the regime, which was in power in 2009, which people were protesting against. At that time, in 1979, the technology of choice for the opposition, now the government in Iran, but the technology of choice for the opposition at that time was the tape recorder, which was the best tool available to smuggle in recordings of the exiled opposition leader carrying his message to the people. So just think about this. Why is it that in 2009 we had the Twitter revolution, but in 1979 nobody was talking about the tape recorder revolution? I think the answer has a lot to do with the changing perceptions of technology. Now, with those historical examples in mind, I want to introduce you to a few more of our principles of using technology for defending human rights. And these are going to set us up to talk about a few more of the examples that will come after the next few slides, assuming that this slide actually skips ahead. There we go. So the second principle for today is another one of my favorites. I think I'm going to use the word favorite a lot today. And this is that behavior is more important than tools, which can also be said as a reminder to remember the 10-90 rule. Using technology for human rights or any other humanitarian initiative is ultimately less about the technology itself than about what people are going to be doing with it. The 10-90 rule essentially states that any campaign is 10% about the technological tool itself and 90% about the people, the planning, the strategy, and the communications surrounding that technology. It's less about the mechanics and more about how you drive the car, essentially. So you have to have a plan in order to make sure that people understand what a given technology can do, what it can't do, how to use it, and of course, just that it even exists in the first place. After all, tools without users don't improve anything. So you can think of the 10-90 rule partially as a matter of marketing, as a matter of fact, since this is really what marketers do. They try to make people aware of a product, what it can do for them, and how they can get it. In our case, that product just happens to be a human rights campaign or a tool or a service. Think of it in the context of crisis mapping tools, like Ushahidi. These are types of software that are used for bringing together reports from a general population and from the members of the general public in order to visualize a situation, generally a crisis, as the name implies, whether that is a conflict or a natural disaster or some kind of grave human rights abuse. The software itself is, of course, really, really important. But you know what's even more important than the software? The data that goes into it. And that data doesn't exist when the people who are affected by the crisis in question don't submit it. Ushahidi is the most famous crisis mapping software in the world right now. But for every one of its successful deployments, there are many others that went nowhere because the people using it focused on the 10% part of the equation and forgot about the 90%. In short, if you put up a crisis map on a website and then do a really bad job of telling people that it's there, or just don't really tell them that it's there, and how and why they might want to use it, it's going to stay blank. And a map with nothing on it doesn't help anyone. Expanding on that point about focusing on behavior as well as tools, make sure that people are always at the center of your campaign, whether technology plays a big role or not. In short, take a people-centered approach, which is our third principle of the day. After all, it's ultimately people who are trying to help here, and the technology is a means to do that. This principle really encapsulates a lot of the others in this list. People are the ones who help other people to build a movement or respond to a crisis. Make sure that your technology enables and empowers people rather than trying to replace them. Also give a lot of thought about how your campaign and the tools it uses will fit into the lives of the beneficiary population. Does it work with their economic circumstances? What about their educational level? Are there any cultural implications to what you're trying to do? One of my favorite examples of doing this well is a project set up in India to give indigenous communities a citizen-based news service. The people creating this project recognized a few things. One, the people in these communities were mostly poor, and while they did have mobile phones, they were generally very basic devices, and electricity was also very scarce. Two, most of the people in question were illiterate, so text-based news would have very limited value. And three, the community in question had a strong oral tradition of passing on information, whether on a day-to-day basis or down through the generations, just by talking. So what resulted from all these considerations was a voice-based mobile news service. People could call in to leave messages for the community about events and things that were happening, and others could call in to listen to such reports. And that's what happens when you take a people-centered approach and build according to local conditions. And with the fourth principle for today, we ask what is a seemingly obvious question. Can the people you're trying to help actually use the same tools that you do? What about the ones that you're planning to introduce into their community? After all, if people can't access the tool that you're using, it won't be very useful, regardless of whether this is for economic, geographical, social, or technological reasons. And this links closely to that first principle about considering your audience and linking behavior to technological tools. For example, don't prepare a YouTube video to communicate with people who have no access to computers or might have a computer that works on a very low bandwidth internet connection. Now, that might sound like an extremely obvious piece of advice, but I've actually met people who have done that exact thing. And it's a prime example of failing to follow these basic principles, like the 10-90 rule and taking a people-centered approach. And technology can be inaccessible to people for a lot of different reasons, whether they're related to economics, security, legal restrictions, or cultural issues. And keep in mind that those conditions can also vary a lot within a single country. We sometimes tend to look at a developed country like Canada, for example, and assume that everyone is going to have access to the internet or mobile phones, and probably both together in the form of a smartphone. However, there are many communities in this country where this is not true, whether they're economically marginalized or geographically remote indigenous communities, or even people at the bottom of the economic pyramid in urban areas. After a talk that I gave once in Toronto on this very topic, I was surprised to have one of the audience members tell me that a lot of the lessons he learned about technology use in sub-Saharan Africa could actually be applied to his work with impoverished communities right in the heart of Canada's largest city, where people had similar accessibility issues with technology and really not being able to access it. I also recently visited Burma a few weeks ago, which is a great example of a place with serious technological accessibility issues. Very, very serious challenges there in terms of communications, especially when you compare it to neighboring countries that are way, very far ahead of it. I'll tell you a little bit about that later on, but first what I'm going to tell you is about the work that the Sentinel Project is doing right now in Kenya and how we've put many of these principles into practice. So the Tana Delta is a region of southeastern Kenya that's seen a lot of hardship. That shouldn't be the case, since the Delta itself is actually a naturally rich area with Kenya's longest river running through it, making the land very fertile. However, the inhabitants have been impacted by environmental issues, government mismanagement, economic pressures, and conflict. And this has all contributed to creating a lot of land disputes, amongst other problems, over the years. The population is a mix of Christians and Muslims with several different ethnic groups, and the largest of these communities are the Pakomo and the Orma. The Pakomo are land-owning farmers, and the Orma are semi-nomadic cattle herders who tend to move their animals around the area along with the seasons. And the two have had long periods of relative peace between them, but they've also come into conflict, particularly over land, at various times. Now, elections in Kenya have almost always brought violence to the country's people, and the run-up to the 2013 general election was no different. There we go. Starting in 2012, local politicians in the Tana Delta started using ethnic grievances to encourage conflict and gain their own political advantage. On August 22nd of that year, a series of massacres began when 50 people were killed during an attack on the village of Raketa. What followed over the next 6 months was a series of attacks back and forth between the Orma and the Pocomo that were more than just armed men meeting on a battlefield to try and gain victory. This was not a war in the conventional sense, but rather the targeting of non-combatant civilians for massacre as members of the two ethnic groups unleashed their pent-up hatred, fear, and anger upon each other. The violence left more than 160 people dead, including unarmed men, women, and children, as well as many more wounded and tens of thousands displaced from their homes. This disrupted the local economy and people's ability to participate in the election and vote. Not surprisingly, a big part of the impact of this violence has been psychological trauma that has left people living in constant fear of being attacked again. I've personally seen groups of people panic and run away from community meetings in response to misinterpreting things like a man running from the rain or children throwing stones onto a metal roof, which sounded to their ears like gunshots. So, what did we do when we first heard about the killings in the Tana Delta? Well, we showed up for a visit. There we go. So we showed up for a visit. We recognized early on that to really understand what was happening in a place like Tana, we had to be there in person and hear it directly from the people affected by the violence and living with its consequences. And that was true whether these were people who had lost family members, been driven from their homes, or potentially even engaged in violence themselves. The international media just wasn't giving the full picture of what was happening. Whether it was BBC, the New York Times, or Al Jazeera, everyone was just reducing the conflict down to its most basic components, oversimplifying it as a typical farmer versus herder conflict. And we wanted to go behind the headlines. So shortly after the violence ended in early 2013, a couple of us registered as election observers and got on a plane to Kenya. Now, once we got out to the Tana Delta, we started meeting with all sorts of people, like local government officials. There we are. Local government officials, security force commanders, and most importantly, community elders and members from both the Orma and Pocomo communities. Our goal was to understand why the violence happened, how the violence unfolded, and to see how the Sentinel Project might be able to prevent it from happening again. This visit was absolutely invaluable, since it gave us a far deeper understanding of the conflict than we ever could have had from afar. Even more than that, being able to see the local conditions and get a sense of what technologies the Tana Delta residents use and how they use them definitely shaped what we did next. What we discovered during our first visit to Tana was that the conflict definitely didn't have just a single cause. If anything, we came away with even more questions than we went in with. Every person we talked to had a different idea about why the violence happened, with some of them sounding more than a little bit like conspiracy theories. A lot of them definitely did have truth to them, a lot of them didn't, and a lot had at least some truth. The trouble was figuring out which ones were which. The people who live in the Tana Delta have limited access to accurate, neutral information and certainly weren't able to investigate rumors like this on their own. And that's where we hit upon the issue that we could address, misinformation. What if there were a way that we could monitor and counter the rumors spreading around the Tana Delta and contributing to that atmosphere of fear and distrust that helped to create violence? We realized that there would certainly be no shortage of rumors. Even within our first brief visit to Tana, we received some pretty extreme reports, which should be coming up any second. So we received some pretty extreme reports from our contacts there, including accusations that someone was supplying 3,000 AK-47s to the Orma community so they could destroy the Pocomo and drive them off the land. Coming from the other side, we also heard that a Pocomo health worker had tried to inject Orma children with poison instead of vaccine. Is there any truth to these rumors? To be honest, probably not, at least in the case of these two. But the important thing isn't whether or not the rumors are actually true. It's that enough people believe they are true and don't have a reliable alternate source of information to consult. After all, we're talking about an area where most people are poorly educated and very impoverished to the point where even someone grazing their cattle on another man's farm is seen as a life and death matter. A rumor of even that seemingly minor crime can lead to major violence. So we had this seed of an idea in our mind, and it was starting to grow based on our new first-hand knowledge in the Tana Delta, with seeing how serious that rumors can be there. Now, keeping in mind all those questions and cultural conditions and accessibility and taking a people-centered approach in order to support real-world action, we let our ideas grow. Eventually, we came up with the concept for Una Hakika, which is Swahili for Are You Sure? Una Hakika is a mobile phone-based information service that enables Tana Delta residents to report rumors they hear by sending a text message or an SMS to a short code, which is like a texting hotline, basically. The Una Hakika team then works to investigate each rumor and determine whether or not it's true. And after that, we respond to the rumor by reporting back to the community with neutral, accurate, and hopefully trusted information. That way, people are better able to make informed decisions about how they relate to neighboring communities. Ideally, what we want to do is encourage a change in people's attitudes in the Tana Delta so that when they hear rumors, instead of believing them automatically, they have a more critical mind and ask themselves and other people, Una Hakika, are you sure? Of course, just a brief visit anywhere might get you started, but it doesn't tell you everything you need to know. Since we couldn't just up and create this information system without knowing more about the situation in Tana, we went home to work on getting the resources to do more. We happened to be very fortunate in that department, and it wasn't too long before we were back in Kenya. After a lot more preparation work, we decided to conduct a survey in the area to get an even better and more quantifiable idea of what technologies people there use, how they use them, and how they receive information, think about information, and transmit information. We also really wanted to know about their attitudes towards rumors. Not only would this give us a deeper understanding of the technological and informational landscape in the Tana Delta, but it would also give us a baseline that we could use to measure changes in people's behaviors and attitudes when it comes to rumors, and therefore know if we were having an impact in the future. So a combined team of Kenyan and Canadian Sentinel Project staff members set off to spend a month in Tana, traveling around to many different villages and interviewing people. We talked to about 250 different people over that time and learned some very interesting, useful things. One of these was the fact that a lot more people than we expected owned mobile phones, with 82% of residents saying they did. And this was really valuable, because one of our early assumptions was that people there use mobile phones on a pretty large scale. And even other Kenyans in Nairobi that we had talked to would ask us questions about Tana when we were proposing this project. Do people there actually have phones? Do they use the internet? So even other people in their own country didn't know what the conditions were in terms of using technology in Tana. So this was great news to find out that 82% of respondents had mobile phones. And what's more, 80% of those people said that other people in their household own mobile phones as well. This was also great news, since we'd been warned ahead of time that phones may be common in the area, but they were likely family assets controlled by the head of the household, which is generally a man. Instead, we found out that Tana had an average of 2.25 phones per household, which really makes Una Hakika a lot more accessible, even more than we had hoped it would be, and a lot more democratic. That's exactly what we wanted. Even better, instead of almost exclusively being ultra-basic devices, people actually, for the most part, had pretty decent phones. Considering that the average income in the area is only a couple of dollars per day, we didn't expect 45% of phone holders to have internet-enabled devices. Not all were actually using the internet, even if they theoretically could, but 31% did, and fully 28% of the people we talked to who had phones were Facebook users. And this drastically influences the way that Una Hakika can interact with our subscribers. Now, another interesting result from the survey was finding that there was a significant information gap, and this is a really key social factor in the Tana Delta. Most people felt well-informed about their own villages, which makes sense, and also well-informed about national events, thanks to national radio and television broadcasts. Where they felt poorly informed, though, was when it came to neighboring villages, even if they were just 500 meters down the road or just across a river. Now think about that. Some people might be able to see another village, but they live such localized lives that they have no idea what happens there. When you add in the fact that the people in that other village might be from a different ethnic group, speak a different language, have a different religion, and might have recently been involved in inter-ethnic violence, you can see why people might be inclined to believe rumors about them. They don't have anything else to act against those rumors. A big part of the reason for this information gap is the complete lack of local media, aside from a few Tana-focused Facebook groups that serve only a small segment of the population. Fortunately, another organization from the UK recently approached us about setting up a radio station for the region. And so the Tana Delta, for the first time ever, is going to have a radio station. So we hope that between that and Una Hakika, we can start to close in this information gap and reduce the risk of violence by giving people more information about the world immediately around them. With a little luck and a lot of hard work, we'll be able to take the 49% of people who heard doubtful information in the past 12 months yet did nothing to verify it and get that number closer to 100%. Of course, it's not all just about mobile phones and Facebook groups and radio broadcasts. Una Hakika needs a human face as well. And that's why we just recently finished training nearly 200 community ambassadors in 16 different villages throughout the Tana Delta. And this is what we spent a month doing just a couple of months ago in May and June. The community ambassadors are going to be our human links between Una Hakika and their own communities, assisting us at all stages of the process in gathering rumor reports, verifying rumors, and then helping to dispel false rumors within their villages. Even more so, they're going to help to ensure that what we do is culturally appropriate and accessible to the people who live there. Now, if someone in the community is unable or unwilling to report directly to Una Hakika through their phone, they can go to another member of their community who can do it on their behalf. That way, we've covered not just the technology, but also the people. So now's a good time to look back at the first four principles of technology for human rights and see how they apply to Una Hakika. After all, if we weren't following our own rules, then I shouldn't be here sharing them with you today. So we started off with principle one, linking technological tools to real-world action. What does that mean in the context of Una Hakika? In this case, we didn't just want to be monitoring and documenting rumors, purely for the sake of documenting. Now, I won't lie, there's definitely a research element to what we're doing, since we want to learn from Una Hakika and apply lessons elsewhere in the future. But we began right away with the desire to actually change the outcome for the better in the Tana Delta by putting better information into the hands of the people who live there. We bring the technology and the information, and they take those real-world actions to prevent violence in their communities. Now, principle two, behavior is more important than tools. This is definitely true in the Tana Delta, and it's exactly why we visited first in order to understand how people live their lives there. We don't like going to a place with a solution in mind before we really know what the problem is. Fortunately, that approach served us well in Tana, and we're now trying to apply it elsewhere, like in Burma. We were able to go learn about behaviors, especially those needed in order to those behaviors that needed to change, and then found the tools to help make that happen. Principle three, taking a people-centered approach. This is definitely a big part of what we're doing in the Tana Delta, and one of the main drivers behind conducting that survey first, which also included a lot of community meetings to introduce ourselves to the people living there and hear their concerns and other feedback on our plans. And principle four is ensuring accessibility. Now, not to repeat myself, but this was a big part of why we did that survey as well. We wanted to understand what technologies, if any, that people were using and how they were using them. Then we built in that human element with the community ambassadors in order to fill the gaps. We adjusted our work and the tools we were using and the structure of our organization and the way it would operate in order to fit the local landscape and culture. Now, I should admit that Kenya is a bit of an easy case when it comes to technology. That's not to say that there aren't very real challenges there, because there most certainly are, but sub-Saharan Africa in general is seeing very rapid growth in mobile phone usage. And within that whole region, Kenya is definitely seen as one of the leaders. And that means that that means we have a lot more to work with in Kenya compared to a place like, let's say, Burma, which I'd like to talk about now in contrast a bit with Kenya. By the way, Burma has officially changed its name to Myanmar, but many foreign governments and local activists and ethnic minorities still use the term Burma. It's a pretty long, complicated story about which is correct, but I'm going to call it Burma here today just to keep things simple. Now, Burma is a country in Southeast Asia, which up until just a few years ago was essentially a military dictatorship. And that's starting to change now, fortunately, and the country seems to be slowly turning more democratic while also opening up to more tourism and international trade. And these are all good things, but some massive, massive problems still remain in the country. And one of these is the treatment of ethnic and religious minorities, especially the Muslim Rohingya. So, who are the Rohingya? They're an ethnic group living in Burma who have been called the most persecuted minority in the world, living in one of the worst humanitarian situations around. Just a few weeks ago, I visited some of the camps where displaced Rohingya are living in Burma, and let me tell you that there is absolutely justification for those two assessments of their situation. They absolutely are very heavily persecuted, and they absolutely live, for the most part, in very atrocious humanitarian circumstances. So, why is this happening? Well, the Rohingya have two things counting against them from the perspective of their persecutors. The first is their ethnicity. Burma is one of the Burma is a very multi-ethnic country with 135 different officially recognized ethnic groups. Unfortunately, the Rohingya are not one of those groups, and so they can be easily denied citizenship despite having lived in Burma for many generations. Essentially, they're treated as illegal immigrants in their own country because their persecutors accuse them of having come in essentially as invaders from neighboring Bangladesh. This is made worse by a strong ethnic nationalist movement in Rakhine State, where the Rohingya live. Hate speech is very common, and a couple of years ago, there was serious inter-ethnic violence in the area that left hundreds of people dead, many homes and mosques burned, and hundreds of thousands of people homeless. Now, the second strike against the Rohingya is that they're Muslims, living in a majority Buddhist country. So religious extremists have also joined in with the Rakhine ethnic extremists in order to attack the Rohingya, portraying them as part of what they think is a Muslim conspiracy to take over Burma. Now, this is ridiculous, but it does find some support amongst the population, and Muslims from other ethnic groups are also living in fear, so they can't offer assistance to the Rohingya for fear of becoming targets themselves. Most Rohingya now live in camps for displaced persons, basically refugees in their own country, and have had humanitarian aid periodically cut off by the government. They cannot leave, and they just barely get enough food and medicine to survive. Hundreds try to flee across the sea in overcrowded boats on a regular basis and often die, or find themselves caught up in human trafficking if they do make it to their destination in Malaysia or Thailand. So, much like we did the first time when we went to the Tana Delta in Kenya, last month we visited Burma to get a better understanding of the situation facing the Rohingya, other Muslims, and the technological landscape in Burma. We were looking for opportunities to help improve the situation and found a lot of challenges facing us. From a technological perspective, Burma is far, far behind the rest of the world, including other less developed countries. Nobody knows exactly how many mobile phones there are in the country currently, but it's probably less than 10% of the population who have them, far, far behind even the most impoverished parts of Kenya, with even fewer people using the internet. For those who do get online, the connections are so slow and unreliable that it's almost impossible to get anything done. Personally, I had to visit some of the most expensive hotels and restaurants in one of the largest cities in the country just to be able to get enough of a Wi-Fi connection or a strong enough Wi-Fi connection to check my email. Now, that's a luxury that I had as a foreigner coming in with some resources, but for the average person living in Burma, that's impossible. So for them, it's even much more difficult to communicate, whether within their own country or with the outside world. Of course, for the Rohingya, the situation is even worse and a lot more serious than just lacking mobile phones and internet access. In their camps, we found people with literally nothing but the clothing they wore, some living in shelters put together from sticks and plastic bags, merely existing in the mud and the constant rain of the wet season. People receive barely enough nutrients to survive, and doctors only visit the camp for a few hours each week to serve a population in the tens of thousands. People who become sick in any serious way merely wait to die. Technologically, in one subcamp of 7,000 people, the leader said that maybe 20 or 30 had mobile phones, and there was no electricity anyway. This serious lack of accessibility to technology for most of the Rohingya really restricts what we can do, and we're now looking at ways to prevent what has happened to them from happening to other Muslim communities throughout Burma, where conditions are a bit more favorable. For those communities, things are difficult, but we have an opportunity to prevent them from getting worse, which is what our team is working on right now. The country overall still has very limited technological infrastructure, but the good news is that this is changing. Two foreign countries are now coming in to offer improved and cheaper services for the people of Burma, which is expected to create an explosion over the next few years in the number of people with mobile phones and using the internet. Now, that's great news for the Sentinel Project and our ability to help. Although Burma presents a very difficult place to operate, we may soon have more options for how to do that. If anything, this really demonstrates the importance of getting on-the-ground experience and knowledge when you're setting up any human rights campaign, especially if you foresee a big role in it for technology to play. It's very rarely possible to just transplant an idea from one place to another. Now, Burma is actually a great introduction to the fifth and final principle of technology for human rights that I'm going to tell you about today. This is the need to assess and manage risks. Nothing in life is ever risk-free, of course, and this is all the more true in the human rights field, where people's lives are very often what are at risk. Similarly, no tool comes without risk, and sometimes the dangers of using a given tool can actually outweigh the opportunities and benefits that it creates. This is especially true any time that a user's private data is involved. For example, a given tool used for circumventing censorship might contain flaws that actually enable repressive regimes to identify users, thus endangering the people it is meant to protect. This has happened in places like Iran and put activists at risk due to mistakes made by well-meaning people outside the country trying to help. We don't want to end up that same way in Burma, a country which, despite its moves towards democracy, remains a relatively hostile environment where elements of the government are definitely complicit in very serious human rights abuses and have an extensive surveillance capability. Understanding who you're up against and what they can do is an essential part of assessing and managing risks in your future work. Now, the question of risk and security is a major challenge, and that's not just the case in places that we usually think of as being repressive countries, like Iran, Syria, Burma, or North Korea. As we've all seen in the revelations coming out of the United States over the past year, even technologies that people use in their everyday lives for seemingly innocuous activities like communicating with friends and family can be threatened by government surveillance. What Edward Snowden showed us is that almost nothing we do online is truly private if people, or more likely governments or even corporations, really want to know what we're saying. Of course, when it comes to technology and security, the conversation becomes way more complex than I can effectively explain today, but the lesson I want you to take away is that you should never assume that anything is fully secure or risk-free. Even if you yourself are no security or risk management expert, when you're building a campaign, get to know the situation in a place where you might work and find the experts who can help you to ask and answer the right questions. And it's not all just about high-tech things that you can do and tools that you can use to secure what you're doing. It's even practices. In 2009, when there were the major pro-democracy protests happening in Iran, the Iranian government watched Twitter very carefully because that helped them to identify who protest leaders might be and where protests were likely to take place. In Egypt, during the Arab Spring protests that overthrew Hosni Mubarak, there were cases of the secret police actually organizing fake protests through Facebook and inviting people to come out to their protests. And then when people actually showed up, they would be waiting there to arrest them. And so these are things that don't really have necessarily a technological solution or a technological cause behind them. It's about how people are using that technology and understanding the risks involved. So the key thing to remember about technology, especially in the human rights realm, is that it's a double-edged sword. Just as much as human rights defenders can use it, so too can a dictator. The human rights defender may take the tools at their disposal and use them to document abuses or share stories with the world and mobilize protest. But the human rights violator may just as well be able to use technological tools for surveillance, censorship, and propaganda to keep people distracted, silenced, and living in fear. Really, what we're looking at is a sort of arms race, especially when it comes to things like online security, as well as surveillance and censorship. There's a sort of escalation as activists might develop a newer and better tool to protect themselves, then governments develop better ways to break that security and spy on activists, followed by another round of improved activist security, and so on. And this isn't likely to stop anytime soon. Now, security and risk is definitely an important topic to cover, but it isn't always the happiest one. So I want to transition a bit now and finish up my talk with one of my favorite topics. Let's have a look at what's on the horizon, and the slide should be coming up any moment now. So, what is the future of technology for human rights? Well, we know for sure that technology isn't going anywhere, and neither are human rights issues anytime soon. So the two are only going to become increasingly tied together. Technology will continue to play a major role in all aspects of society and will therefore find new applications for both defending and violating human rights depending on whose hands it's in. And that's why we always need to be thinking about what's coming next. Of course, it's impossible to predict the future, but there are definitely some general trends that we can be sure will continue. First of all, remember that arms race that I mentioned just a minute ago? Well, we can fully expect that to continue escalating between the proponents of online censorship and surveillance on the one hand and advocates of privacy, free speech, and net neutrality on the other. As I mentioned, this sort of thing has very much been in the news over the past year due to revelations about massive U.S. government surveillance programs, but some large communications companies are also making efforts to erode what is known as net neutrality by controlling internet access and the quality of that access to different types of online content. In that sort of arms race environment, the practice known as hacktivism is also likely to continue growing in importance. Hacktivism is the use of online attacks against governments, corporations, and other targets, which the attackers say is in the service of a cause. A great example is the organization Anonymous with their famous faceless logo. Hacktivism is generally very controversial since it often gains a high media profile and can make the people the hacktivists are supposedly trying to help actually look bad by associating with what is illegal activity. Governments and corporations feel continually threatened by it, possibly leading to a general distrust of technological activism in general. Fortunately, the increasing prevalence of technology in all aspects of life make it unlikely that hacktivism will completely overshadow other, more legitimate forms of technological activism. On the upside, we can also expect a lot more of evolution in the tools available to us as new social media and other communications platforms and techniques come into existence. Activists will also continue finding ways to adapt them to their needs. Currently existing tools will find new uses, and new tools will be developed. It's exciting to think about the potential here and what things might look like 10 or 20 years in the future. That's also pretty difficult, since many of the tools that we consider to be commonplace today would have been unpredictable 10 or 20 years ago. So looking forward, we have that same sort of foggy obstruction to being able to predict what's coming up in the future. Another trend will be the general disappearance of privacy and anonymity as governments and corporations gain those increasingly powerful data gathering and surveillance capabilities that I already mentioned. The problem is that it won't just be restricted to the online world, since facial recognition software is starting to come into use by various governments and security forces. This likely means that the days of public anonymity, when you could literally just disappear into a crowd, are coming to an end in some countries. It's not too uncommon for security forces or law enforcement agencies to try doing this manually by publicizing security footage or other images of people engaged in crimes and then asking members of the public to help identify them. This sort of crowdsourced facial recognition can definitely put to legitimate uses, such as by the Metropolitan Police in the aftermath of the London riots in 2011, but it can also be put to far more repressive uses, such as when the Iranian government wanted to identify protest leaders. Software is now commercially available, which can perform the same function. If that technology is put into the hands of regimes, it suddenly becomes much easier for them to identify, apprehend, and abuse activists, and yet another complication to the security landscape. And the third and final trend that we're currently seeing is less related to entirely new technologies coming into existence, and really more about the opening up of formerly exclusive technologies as they become more accessible to members of the general public. This is particularly true of tools that until recently were available only to governments, especially militaries, which are now being repurposed for humanitarian use, such as geospatial technology, and I'll have more to say on that in just a second. Now, this trend might be new in relation to specific tools, but it's actually pretty well established historically. For example, many technologies which are now commonplace, such as radios, microwaves, and airplanes, received much of their early developmental support due to their military applications or other strategic importance or commercial importance. They later opened up and were adapted for a wide variety of more peaceful purposes. Now, I know that I've been already using the word favorite a few times, but the two examples I have now to close out my talk, particularly related to this trend, really do excite me. First up is satellite imagery, which is a subset of that geospatial technology I mentioned, and probably the most audacious new area opening up to human rights defenders. That being said, using this technology still requires large amounts of money, so with the exception of a few high-profile and well-funded NGOs, it's still mostly inaccessible to activists and advocates, for now. Fortunately, we can expect that to change soon. Satellite technology was once the exclusive preserve of powerful governments, which use it to protect their own interests and achieve their own goals by gathering intelligence on their adversaries. Fortunately, this is yet another example of business-focused innovation actually indirectly benefiting humanitarians. Because commercial services are now available, which can provide increasingly detailed imagery to members of the public. In light of the great expense associated with technology, these companies even sometimes provide discounted or donated imagery to humanitarians. The Satellite Sentinel Project, which is different from My Sentinel Project, the names are just a coincidence, was the first NGO to use satellite imagery for human rights. In this case, it's largely focused on monitoring mass atrocities in Sudan and South Sudan. Their initial mission began around the time of the South Sudanese referendum on independence a couple of years ago, with a focus on identifying bombardments, attacks, mass graves, destroyed villages, displaced populations, and generally using satellite imagery to verify reports of abuses on the ground. The idea here was that they could use this evidence in order to ensure that the Sudanese government and the perpetrators of these atrocities knew someone was watching and try to deter them from taking those actions. And it's not just the Satellite Sentinel Project either, since the Amnesty International has used this tool as well to document atrocities in Syria and show the scale of North Korean prison camps. We've even used it a little bit ourselves at the Sentinel Project, and I see a lot of potential to continue doing so. And lastly, even more accessible right now are unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs for short, though they're more commonly known as drones. These tools have so far mostly been associated with their use by governments and militaries, particularly the United States, and are sometimes actually implicated in human rights abuses. This has given UAVs an often negative image in many people's minds, but the fact is that the majority of those flying around the world right now are unarmed and operate in civilian hands, whether for commercial, recreational, or humanitarian purposes. UAVs have already been used in fields such as law enforcement, natural disaster response, and even conservation work, such as anti-poaching patrols. The World Wildlife Fund has launched just such a project in South Africa to track poachers using UAVs, and our thinking at the Sentinel Project is that if UAVs can be used to protect endangered animals, then why can't they be used to protect endangered humans? Now we're just looking for the right opportunity to actually put that concept into practice. UAVs are generally used to gather imagery, much like satellites are, but they offer some distinct advantages. First, they can provide much more local control and faster response than satellites, which makes them ideal for putting directly into the hands of human rights defenders on the ground for use in things like early warning and documentation of human rights violations. They've already been employed in some places to document protests, with notable examples coming from Poland, Russia, and Turkey, but this is still on a small scale. That's very likely to change soon due to the second advantage that UAVs have in terms of being far, far more affordable than satellite imagery, with the potential to build very capable devices for only hundreds or thousands of dollars instead of millions. Of course, they wouldn't be on the same level as what can be used by governments, but they still offer a huge advantage to human rights defenders. Not only are they relatively cheap and easy to buy or build, but a large community of people around the world are already doing exactly that, doing creative things with them just for fun. The technology is already there, it's available, and is practically just waiting for human rights defenders to put it into use. So, if we're going to see these positive trends continue and do our best to restrain the negative ones, we need to remember those principles of technology for defending human rights.